This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
What kind of programs does this school have? How are the test scores? How many kids do a classroom? Homes.com knows these are all things you ask when you're home shopping as a parent. That's why each listing on Homes.com includes extensive reports on local schools, including photos, parent reviews, test scores, student-teacher ratio, school rankings, and more. The information is from multiple trusted sources and curated by Homes.com's dedicated in-house research team. It's all so you can make the right decision for your family. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Can't you see it? The world powered by solar and renewable energy. Here at Graybar, with years of renewables experience, we live in that world. Get in touch to see for yourself.
We are now ready to depart.
Book your visit at graybar.com. Yep, Graybar does that.
All right, here we go on a Thursday. It's Cody and Gold, Alex Gold, Drew Nixon producing the show. Logan Weber, first time hosting with me today, man. Cody will be back tomorrow. He's out for a snow day. That's what we'll, basically, right? He's out for a snow day today. He'll be back tomorrow. What's up, man?
Hey, how we doing? Yeah, applaud Cody for it. He's got to go full dad today.
That's exactly what it is.
I appreciate it from her.
Full dad mode. I don't know if that's, he's making them grilled cheese sandwiches here in about an hour or something. I don't know what the whole thing entails there, but we'll talk to him about that tomorrow. He'll be back at it, but this will be fun, man. For those that don't know, hopefully they've caught your show after hours in the evenings a little bit. I know you hosted last night. You're hosting again tonight. You got a long day ahead of you, man.
Man, I'm excited for it, though, honestly. I mean, I get to talk about sports for a living, so who am I to complain about the number of hours, for
there
sure.
There you go. So we'll have some fun over the next four. We'll try to get to know you a little bit, too. And this will be fun hosting with somebody for the first time as well. You guys can interact with us throughout the show. Jay Southland, Tow Service, text line 913-586-7965. And, of course, the video stream will be up and running shortly as well. Facebook, Twitch, YouTube, X, Twitter, whatever we're calling it these days, all of that you can watch as well. A little bit later on today in the show, we will be joined by Josh Vernier. He, of course, is out in sunny and warm Surprise, Arizona. So around 12:45, he'll check in with us. And there's a chance maybe in this first hour we could have a player join us, but that's to be determined based on some availability. But if we get a player today, that'd be obviously pretty cool. Spring training is underway. And a reminder, tomorrow, first spring training game of the season right here on 96.5 The Fan. That'll be underway at 2 o'clock. Plus Vern's got his hot stove show tonight, I think right before Logan, you hop on with after hours. So Vern will be going there. But I actually want to start with the NFL today. And we know all the offseason discussion about left tackle and the discussion about what's the plan at offensive line. And I think the Chiefs, of course, have somewhat of their plan laid out internally, whether or not they are able to execute it. As we know from many, many years ago, Trent Williams was once a plan A, and then they had to go to plan B and C, and that resulted in Orlando Brown Jr. being acquired. But a former NFL offensive lineman and the brother of former Chief Mitchell Schwartz, Jeff Schwartz, was talking on his own social media channels, and he does a variety of stuff, Fox Sports Radio, et cetera, about how he would fix the O-line. I thought it was really interesting, a point he made about Kingsley Sumataia, and he thinks perhaps fans have already moved on a little bit too quickly on him as a tackle, or at least as an offensive lineman in this Chiefs organization. Listen to this from Jeff Schwartz.
The other idea that I've seen around is just draft another offensive lineman at 31. Whew, buddy, you have other holes on the roster, right? I'll mention them again, right? So the pass rush was horrendous against the Eagles. Now, their offensive line is really good. We get that. They stopped the runner really well, but you need someone to rush the passer. This is a great defensive tackle class, so follow that away for a second. Your middle linebacker most likely going to walk. I don't think the Chiefs are going to play Bolton. I'm not sure they're going to pay Reed, but you have Hicks and you have Cook. Like, maybe that's a solution right there. You probably want one more veteran wideout, especially with Rice being suspended at some point next season. But Rice and Worthy look like a good combination. You need more, though, right? Running back, it's a good draft for a back. I think they're going to draft a back, but you need explosive back, maybe another tight end. Like, there's other holes. You need kind of roster guys for your offensive line. There's other holes that they have to fill besides left tackle. And it's not a tackle class that's great. And so you're just drafted a project in Kingsley. who hasn't even played yet, and now you want to draft another project at 31, but you haven't even tried the other guy yet. Like, unless the Chiefs decide Kingsley is the worst offensive lineman they've ever drafted, and he is not going to play. Eric Fisher, guys, was not good as a rookie. Not good in his second year, maybe by his third year. Like, they eventually got him good. Like, you need reps, but the reps last year, again, were limited because the Chiefs' goal was trying to win a championship.
So that was Jeff Schwartz. I agree with a decent chunk of what he had to say. For starters, I think the last point is key to remember with any of the young players a year ago. They were in the middle of a three-peat campaign, and you didn't have time to say, all right, we'll go with the growing pains of a Kingsley or Wanya Morris. We got to fix this. They thought DJ Humphries could fix that. Then he gets hurt in that Chargers game. And then, of course, we all know they settle in with Joe Tooney. And for a majority of the time, it was effective until it wasn't. In the Super Bowl, obviously, Logan. But the thought about Kingsley, it is true. He's only played two games. I think to say that he can never help this franchise would be foolish. But I'll be honest, I really cannot imagine them going into next season with Kingsley at left tackle. Now, can he be the guard? Can he be the right guard if Trey Smith walks and then the Chiefs move on from him because he's going to get a huge deal? Yeah, I think that's in the cards. But I don't think Kingsley can be your left tackle, despite him being correct that, hey, it's only two games of a sample size.
Oh, I completely agree with everything you just said. I understand the thought process that, yeah, you didn't give him enough run to have him figure himself out. But I also stand by the fact that he seems to me as more of a road grader type. I mean, he's not the strongest. He's certainly not the fastest. He doesn't have the most precise footwork. And those are some of that stuff you can obviously work on. But with this Chiefs team and the position that they're currently in, the success that they've had recently, I still don't believe you have the time to let him figure it out. I agree with you. I think he would be a good fit at right guard. I think he would be a good fit at right tackle. I think he's got a lot of versatility. Wanya Morris is more of a swing tackle type, in my view. I think he's a depth piece. I don't think he is an every down, every weekend sort of left tackle. So if Trey Smith walks this offseason, which I think is becoming increasingly more likely day by day, it absolutely makes no sense. If they weren't going to tag him for $23, $24, $25 million, you're not going to go out and pay him $23 to $25 million on a 4 or 5 year deal, especially with the salary cap increase. He's going to earn a pretty penny. You have other needs you have to get met, right? What do you decide to do with Nick Bolton? Because we know how much Steve Spagnuolo loves him. And I think there are options at your disposal at the tackle position if you choose it. I agree that maybe you don't go with a left tackle at 31. I would like to see them attack the interior of their defensive line at 31. Or maybe if Charles Omenihu walks, you're going to let Uche walk because he wasn't, he didn't provide anything.
His social media's favorite player, Josh Uche. Yeah, everybody was so devastated when he didn't play. He didn't play,
so they're not going to bring him back. There's no love lost there. So maybe you attack it with an edge rusher. I'm not sure. But I think that there are guys in free agency. I look at Alaric Jackson with the Los Angeles Rams, who just put up a career year. He was top 20 among all left tackles in both run blocking grade and pass blocking grade, at least according to Pro Football Focus. I think he would be a reasonably priced option at left tackle, maybe a step down from the Orlando Brown that was in Kansas City, but serviceable, a guy that you're not constantly having to question yourself about week after week.
So Kingsley, I think they kind of told us how they view him long term anyway, the way they went about their roster late in the year and in the postseason, which even the game day inactives, when Wanya was the inactive player, to your point about him being more of a swing tackle, and Kingsley was active as a guard, because they weren't going to have Kingsley go out and play, right tackle or something like that. So I think that was already telling where the organization is shifting. I still believe he'll end up being a guard. The tackle point that you just made, and Jeff Schwartz did, about the draft aspect, I think that is something that everybody should remember heading in. We all know priority number one is the left tackle situation. I think the sad reality might be this offseason, that long-term answer left tackle may not be able to be found this offseason. Now, they need to find somebody that can start for 17 games or hopefully more, right, in the postseason, and that can give them average to above average play. They don't have to get a Hall of Fame level play out of their left tackle. Not at all. We went through this a couple weeks ago. You go back and look at the Brady's left tackles and even Peyton Manning's left tackles. They weren't all first ballot Hall of Famers. They weren't all Trent Williams starting at left tackle. They just need to have somebody that, of course, can be there consistently and give them above average play. But like the free agent class, I know you mentioned a name. Like, Ronnie Stanley's out there. These are not long-term really, you know, options. Like Cam Robinson, okay, I don't think the Chiefs will give him the long-term deal that somebody else will. And so therefore, I don't think there's a long-term option at left tackle. So at 31, you're like, well, then they need to go draft one. The only way I think the Chiefs through the draft are actually addressing left tackle effectively is if they do something they've only done a handful of times under Brett Veach. And that, of course, is trading up. But you're at 31 and the tackle draft, we'll see what happens at the combine. It sure sounds like if you're going to get one of those surefire, close to surefire tackles as you can have in the NFL out of the draft, you got to get inside the top 15. And I don't know if they're willing to do that, but that's the only way I think they're taking a left tackle in the first round, because Jeff Schwartz is correct. If you take one at 31, it's no different than what we're talking about here. It'd be, are you going to camp with, I guess we'll keep Kingsley's name in the conversation, but with Kingsley, random rookie at 31, and then what, a vet? And you're basically in the exact same spot. Unless, as he said, they just are already completely done with Kingsley, and I don't think they are. I think they're going to have him project to potentially be the starting right guard for this team in 2025.
If you get a left tackle at 31, there is just as good a chance, if you were to avoid that, take somebody else at 31, there's a very real chance that that same left tackle may fall into the middle of round two. I mean, you're exactly right. When it comes to the tackle positions in the draft, if you don't hit on the first two or three or maybe even four tackles, usually within the first 15 or 16 picks, it's always a very top-heavy position in the NFL draft year after year after year. And this is a deep draft class at other positions. I think you could go get a very serviceable potential day one starter at defensive tackle at 31 if you wanted to.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
could find a handful of running backs in the second round if you wanted to. And you're exactly right. Trading up, yeah, that's how you go get a serviceable day one starter at left tackle. But Veach hasn't expressed a real willingness to do that, to move up to that extent, to move up 15, 16
McDuffie
spots.
McDuffie was, what, 21?
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't a massive leap from the back half of the draft to the front half of the draft. He's only really done that once, and that was for Patrick Mahomes. They only have six picks in this draft to begin with. So their draft capital is not pouring out of their pockets. They're not capital rich in that sense. And if there's one thing we know about this Chiefs team, they have so much money already tied up into their top six or seven players with Mahomes and Kelsey and Tooney. And unfortunately, Jawan Taylor is making $20+ million a year. You know, over 60% of your salary cap is tied up in your top six or seven players. You do not have the money at your disposal to try to fill the other 45 spots on your roster with just free agents. You need draft capital to go find guys, especially in the later rounds, which they've become so good at. You can't really afford to give up those pieces to try to move up on a left tackle that still may or may not be the answer.
I think we'll also learn a lot of how they feel about this left tackle draft class too, based off of how aggressive or not aggressive they are in when free agency opens up at the left tackle spot. Because the names, Ronnie Stanley, et cetera, these names, I got a lot of questions about a lot of them, but can they just go ahead and say, we are willing to risk the injury stuff with Ronnie Stanley? Because that's what you'd be doing if you sign him. You're risking that he's available or not. He was available this last year for the Ravens, 17 games, but the reason why the Ravens are moving on, he's getting old and he's had injury concern. Two scenarios that I know a lot of fans and you guys listening are not going to like, but if they're not going to be ultra aggressive and trade up, when they signed Jawan Taylor a couple years ago, everybody thought he was going to be the left tackle. Now, they never gave him a single rep at left tackle, like not even in practice, I don't think. Not a single rep, and we all know he's playing right tackle, and you might be saying, well, he hasn't even been that great at right tackle, and I understand, but is Jawan Taylor willing to give it a go at left tackle? If not, I think you might be sitting here, and as much as fans won't like it, DJ Humphrey still might be in the mix again at left tackle next year if they bring him back. But I think they can wait on that. That is not plan A necessarily, or plan B. That's what I'm saying about plan C or D. Is there another guy we're not even thinking of that's on a team like Orlando Brown Jr. from a couple years ago that is a year left or so on his first year deal, and that franchise is already not really sold on giving that guy the money, and the Chiefs say, hey, we'll trade for him. That was the Orlando Brown Jr. trade with Baltimore. So we'll get back into this a little bit later on, but a lot of questions, and I still think Jawan Taylor one is interesting season, unless he flat out told him that, hey, I'm not playing left tackle. But we'll get back to that a little bit later on. Alex Skoll, Logan Weber here on Cody and Gold. So let's talk about college basketball, because last night the Missouri Tigers had, I actually think, their most impressive win of the season, considering how efficient they were on offense. when you score over 100 points in an SEC game, and they were at, what, 92 points with 6 or 7 minutes to go, and then it kind of slowed out a little bit, but they still ended up well over 100 points scored. That offense, for a stretch or two, was as good as any offense in the country yesterday against top five Alabama. So another top five win for the Missouri Tigers to add to their resume. And I wonder where everybody's expectation is at for them. There's still SEC play to go. There's still, what, 5 games, I think, on their schedule, SEC tournament, best conference in the country. But when you're pacing, I think Missouri might end up with 25 wins heading into the NCAA tournament when this thing is over, and they've got the resume and everything like that. The expectation for them should be not just winning a game or two in the tournament. Like, it's Sweet 16 or more for Missouri. That should be the bar. And I understand, like, historically that program, Elite Eight, is their high mark. They look a lot like the team in 08-09. That team lost in the Elite Eight. But that team was pretty dominant during the regular season, and put it all together, they're fun to watch. And when you look at the way they're going about it and what they've done from a year ago, where they didn't win a single conference game, which is just ridiculous to think about, to now where they're at, guys, they might be a number 3 or number 4 seed in the NCAA tournament. And if you're a 3 or 4, it's not just getting, it may not even just be getting out of the first weekend. It might be even a further run than that.
Oh, no question. I mean, if you're a top 4 seed, the expectation should always be, you got to get to the second weekend. You got to get to the Sweet 16, because that is where the seeding has placed you. This team is remarkable in the fact that the scoring can come from a variety of places. They have great interior players. You know, Mark Mitchell coming over from Duke, he has been a massive boon for them on the interior. Although he's not always the most aggressive and reliable rebounder, he can score and score at will. I mean, he had 31 last night. And when you have a guy like Caleb Grimm, who was an all Big 12 player at Iowa State, that comes off the bench and can put 20 on your dome on a night by night basis, that's pretty remarkable stuff. I mean, Tony Perkins coming over from the University of Iowa, I am an Iowa fan. I watched him for 4 years. He's a guy that brings great intensity, great defense. He's got active hands, willing and able passer. He's not the most consistent scorer. He's the kind of guy where he'd drive you crazy as an Iowa fan, where he'd have 25 one night and be 12 of 14 from the field, and then the next night he'd be 2 for 14. It just never made any sense. But he doesn't have to be the number 1 or 2 or even the number 3 scoring option on this team. Tamar Bates has really, I think, taken on his role and accepted what his responsibility is for this Mizzou team, and he's thrived because of it. Same with Anthony Robinson. This team can score in so many different ways. I mean, they're an incredibly deep roster. I mean, when you've got guys like Aiden Shaw and T.O. Barrett that were, consensus 4-star recruits coming out of high school that are barely playing, if not playing at all, in these games, you're doing something right. And Dennis Gates, in my view, he's the SEC Coach of the Year this year, if not potentially the National Coach of the Year this year, for what he's been able to do for a team that did not win a single game in the SEC last year to, you're one game away from having at least a 500 record in the SEC. I mean, above 500 in the SEC.
When they're playing in Nashville for the SEC tournament, they've got a chance. I mean, that's going to be an unbelievable conference tournament. It's the best conference in the country, but they got a chance to win that and improve their seeding from there. I mean, that's how good they are. Now, it's the NCAA tournament, so when we get there in a month or less than a month, and matchups and all that, like, am I saying that there's no chance they can get upset? Of course not. Like, this is the NCAA tournament, and upsets happen, and, you know, I'm sure, you know, if you're an MU fan, I don't have to tell you the history there and everything like that of being a top seed. But they look a lot like an 08-09 team that made it to the Elite Eight. That's what the Missouri Tigers look like right now, and we'll see the draw and all that. The way it's trending now, like, they're going to be probably playing close to home. They're probably going to be playing in Wichita, which I think will be the closest site that they could play in, if I'm not mistaken, for the NCAA tournament pods and everything like that. So they should have that in their back pocket as well. That last night, I still think, I know they had beaten Florida on the road and things like that, and so you'll say that was more impressive because it was in Gainesville. I understand this was at home, but to do that to Alabama, Alabama's now dropped 2 in a row, but they were to Auburn and Missouri. They're not bad losses or anything like that. But the offensive output was just ridiculous last night. But I think the bar absolutely is raised. And this is how college basketball works. Like, yes, going into the season, you would have just taken an NCAA tournament berth, I'm sure, if you're a Missouri Tiger fan. Now, no, you get greedy. This is what you do. The bar absolutely has been raised when you're winning. This is their third top 5 win of the year, too.
Yeah.
you get three top five wins, you feel like you can beat anybody in the country. When your offense is that good, you really can beat anybody in the country. And so that was ultra impressive from Dennis Gates and the Missouri Tigers. Coming up here in the next couple weeks, we'll see the latest bracketology stuff and where the path could actually be. Here in 10 minutes, though, on Cody and Gold, we'll get to the NFL. Adam Schefter was talking about the NFL storylines and some of the biggest storylines, not just in Kansas City, but in the NFL. I thought it was interesting, and it got me thinking about what my number one storyline as well. We'll do that in just a bit. But spring training is underway, and there was a pretty funny story. Michael Massey, who we've had on the show before, of course, and he was talking about a time in which George Brett maybe was critical of his performance. There's more details to the story, and Cody was texting with him too, but that he can't share publicly. But this is what Michael Massey was saying. It's a hilarious story about George Brett and then Michael Massey's dad.
I have a text from a number I don't recognize, and the first sentence is, "Hey, this is George Brett." First thing I do, actually, is I take the message and I send it to my family group chat. I'm like, "Guys, George Brett is texting me about how bad I'm playing. Like, this is sick." I get a call from our travel coordinator. Phone's ringing. I'm like, "Great, here I'm getting sent down. I'm hitting 130. He's like, "Hey, man, I'm so sorry about what happened." I'm like, what are you talking about?" And he's like, I saw, you know, what George sent you, and you know, he got after you pretty good. You know, he's like, "I even saw that he said you should be in AAA the way you're playing right now." Actually, it was AA. My dad called George Brett on the phone and basically told him he was going to fight him the next time he saw him. And so it's a really interesting thing because George and I are unbelievable friends now. Just, I love George and I've gotten to know him really well, but it is an interesting story how we met.
Massey's dad was ready to fight George Brett. He was ready to fight George Brett over a text. It's unbelievable story, and it's hilarious. And again, I think there's some more details specifically on the conversation, which is great. But one, it just shows, like, no matter who you're dealing with, like, you're going to be protective of your kids or your son, or in this case, or whatever it is. But that, considering George Brett's involved in the conversation, just imagining if you're Michael Massey and your dad's mad, George Brett is texting you about how poor you're playing, and your dad's getting involved in wanting to fight George Brett. That's an all-timer.
Should Michael recommend that his dad get a hold of Greg Nettles? just for point of reference, maybe some tips in regards to potentially getting into a tete-a-tete with George Brett? Yeah, I mean, give the guy some credit. And, you know, give him some applause for being defending his child. But to try to argue baseball topics with George Brett, I know that Michael's dad played baseball, I think at like Illinois, played in the 80s or something, played for the Fighting Illini, but this is George Brett we're talking about still. I mean, was it a little bit harsh? Yeah, probably. And Massey has proven to be a very, very serviceable player for the Royals. I think he was excellent last year, but it's an interesting story, something Michael Massey will remember forever, I'm sure.
Yeah, there was it's on, if you want, there's the full podcast episode. It was an Apple podcast episode. There's also a YouTube video. If you literally, the video on YouTube is titled that time Michael Massey's dad threatened George Brett. The fact that like that, the fact that title even exists for a video is all time if you're Michael Massey. And again, George Brett, it sounds like, was obviously cool about the whole thing as well. And then, as you heard from Massey, like, now him and George Brett are fairly close and everything. I don't remember the exact timeline of where it was at. And the other funny thing is Michael Massey, he's told us, we've had him on the show, like, his dad played baseball too. Mm-hmm. So it's not like his dad's coming from a place of not, like, you know, just not knowing anything about baseball or anything like that. His dad played for Illinois, I think.
I think it's funny that it's not like he just called him, you know, to rip him a new one, essentially, and, you know, go off on him for texting Michael that. But to basically say, "Hey, man, I'm down to fight you. You know, this is, when is this happening? Where and when? If you don't stop, I'm going to have to throw some hands over this."
Yeah, his hands are rated E for everyone.
That's right.
You can go to the Odyssey app too, the Foul Territory podcast. If you just search for that, you'll find it on the Odyssey app. It's titled Michael Massey's Crazy George Brett Story. And that was a story he recounted. He also talked about, of course, he's a huge Chicago fan, so he talked about the 2005 White Sox team. And you guys know, if you've listened at all when Massey's come on the show, he's a huge Chicago Bears fan too, a huge NFL fan. So maybe we'll have to try to get Massey on the show from spring training, from surprise, and follow ups with some more questions about how that whole thing actually went as well. All right, coming up next, though, let's go ahead and get into the NFL a little bit. Adam Schefter was talking about some of the top storylines. One of them I agree with But I have another one to throw out your way as well. That's coming up next year on Cody and Gold.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof like Aloe, Allbirds, or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling and for shoppers buying simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet and the not so secret secret with Shop Pay that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell whenever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout experience as business powerhouses like Aloe, Allbirds, and Skims. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
All right, everybody, it's here. The March to Spring Training and Opening Day is officially upon us. Hey, I'm Rob Bradford from Baseballs and Boring, and we'll have you covered every single day with instant reactions to late-breaking signings, determining which players are, yes, truly in the best shape of their lives, and behind-the-scenes stories from all the excitement and intrigue that spring training brings. Follow Baseballs and Boring in the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, just getting started here on a Thursday. It's Cody and Gold, Alex Gold, Drew Nixon with you. Logan Weber, he's filling in for Cody today. Cody will be back tomorrow. Reminder, coming up tonight, Hot Stove Show with Vern. He's going to have Chris Bubich, Ben Kuderna, and Annie Rogers on the show. 6 o'clock here on 96.5 The Fan. And then Logan will be on with After Hours, 7 to 9 this evening. So we get to know Logan a little bit. You don't have to give the full story or whatever. Share whatever you want to share. But you're refreshing your email throughout the entire show today.
Yeah, I am. My wife and I are buying a house.
There you go. Congrats, man.
Thank you very much. It's our first home down in the Grain Valley area, which is like south of Blue Springs here in the metro. We're very, very excited about it, but right now we're like in the process of awaiting escrow.
Okay.
Like, so I don't know what you want to call it. Our mortgage broker, whatever you want to call it. Right. Our lending agent, she has let us know that we could potentially be entering escrow here in the next day or two. So I'm constantly refreshing my email and looking at my text and my phone to see if I'm getting a text message from my wife that is confirming one way or the other if we've entered escrow or not, because we're pretty thrilled about it. You know, I've lived in some sort of communal space since I was 18 and went to college for the first time, right? It was a dorm, and then I was living in a house with three other guys that I was friends with in college, and then I lived in an apartment complex, and I've lived in apartments since then down in the Springfield market where my wife and I were previously. So to like have our first space for ourselves, like I own this, right? Like this is everything we put into it is coming back to us in some way, shape, or form versus renting a property, which kind of feels like you're just throwing money away.
Totally.
And there's a little bit of a pride in that, you know, oh, the toilet stopped working. Well, it's my toilet, so I have to replace it, right? Or the furnace went out, which is a giant pain, but it's also, there's also a little bit of a sense of pride with that as well.
Well, congrats. Hopefully everything goes well, but yeah, I totally understand. I'd be refreshing the email and checking my phone constantly as well. You guys can text us on the Jay Southlands host service text line 913-586-7965. Let's talk a little NFL though, because Adam Schefter was going through his offseason storylines. He said the biggest NFL storyline this offseason is Matthew Stafford's impact on therefore where Aaron Rodgers is going to go. And if you guys aren't familiar, there's rumors out there that Matthew Stafford maybe could get moved out of L.A., and then is he going to the Giants? Are the Steelers in play? Where could Matthew Stafford end up? And that will have a trickle-down effect, because if Matthew Stafford doesn't move, well, then, of course, there's another job or two maybe out there for someone like Aaron Rodgers. If Stafford gets traded, it takes a destination. I don't think Sean McVay is going to bring in Aaron Rodgers, so it takes a destination away. I agree with that being one of the bigger storylines. I mean, Matthew Stafford, if we're talking about for what would be the third offseason in the last 5-plus years where a Super Bowl winning quarterback would be on the move, of course, Russell Wilson and then Aaron Rodgers himself. It hasn't worked out with the initial trade. I'll say that for Matthew Stafford. Like, hey, man, I don't think he has a no-trade clause. I'm not sure how that works with him. I can't remember in his contract, but Aaron Rodgers won it out. it was a disaster after leaving Green Bay. Russell Wilson wanted out of Seattle, or didn't want out. They wanted him out. He goes to Denver. It was a disaster. And then he was okay this year in Pittsburgh. So typically the track record, other than Tom Brady leaving for Tampa, it hasn't really turned out all that well for the guys that chosen to leave. There's always an outlier. You know, the Colts forced Peyton Manning out. He didn't want to leave. And we all know he wins the ring there in Denver. So I was thinking, like, what's our and my biggest NFL storyline? That one's a huge one. I'm actually most fascinated by what happens in Cincinnati, and not just because we give Drew a hard time about the Bengals and everything as much as we can. But truly, there's a major impact on the rest of the AFC and the rest of the NFL. Do they or do they not pay both Ja'Marr Chase and T. Higgins? If they do, okay, not a whole lot changes. They keep that core together, but what happens defensively? If they do not bring back T. Higgins, where does he end up? Does he stay in the AFC? Does he go to the NFC? I think Ja'Marr Chase is getting paid. So really, we're talking about T. Higgins here. But what do they do there could have a huge trickle-down effect as someone that's in the AFC, someone that recognizes they have one of the top quarterbacks in football. What they do this offseason with T. Higgins, I think, is a huge storyline.
Oh, no question. Because if you re-sign T. Higgins, because you're right, they are going to pay Ja'Marr Chase. They have to. I mean, he just put up the receiving triple crown. He's still in his mid-20s. He may not have even reached the peak of his powers yet. You have to keep him around. The relationship he has with Joe Burrow, which is important because Ja'Marr Chase does have a tendency to kind of go off the handle sometimes, and Burrow appears to be maybe the only guy that can rein him in at times. Didn't do enough of that against the Chiefs this past season, but if you pay T. Higgins, that offense and that passing game is solidified for the very, very, you know, distant future. But if you do that, the defense becomes an even bigger question mark because Trey Hendrickson needs to get paid this offseason as well. He just came off a year where he was an all-pro, a defensive player of the year finalist, and he led the NFL in sacks. He's going to earn a pretty penny. He's going to become a top five highest paid defensive end in the National Football League. Do you try to pay him too? So now you're paying Ja'Marr Chase, T. Higgins, and Trey Hendrickson all in the same offseason, all of which are going to be making $20+ million per year on top of what Burrow's making. You're tying up roughly 50 to 60% of your total salary in those four guys. And rightfully so, because they're four incredibly talented players.
But the
rest
of your defense, you're going to be having the same issue.
Exactly.
I think. I know Drew and I disagree on this, but like, because it's the lack of trust maybe in the draft picks and everything. I just would rather use my resources to bump up that defense a little bit because, look, Burrow and Ja'Marr Chase with Chase Brown, the running back, that should be good enough to still have a top-tier offense, whether or not you bring back T. Higgins or not. I would work on a deal with Hendrickson because of the defensive aspect, but I feel like you need to bolster that defense. I don't want to turn this into a huge Cincinnati topic necessarily, but just I think that is a huge storyline in the NFL, along with Matthew Stafford. What's another one for you guys and the text line as well?
Yeah, one that fascinates me. What happens in San Francisco this offseason? And I can't really just point to one thing with the San Francisco 49ers. This is a team, two seasons ago, was in the Super Bowl and was favored by many in that Super Bowl against the Kansas City Chiefs, and they fell short. This offseason, you've got major decisions to make. What happens with Deebo Samuel? It feels very similar to what happened with Brandon Ayuk last offseason. Ayuk was talking, hey, I want to get paid. If you're not going to pay me, trade me, and then they paid him. Deebo Samuel says he wants out until he looks around at some of the potential suitors for him, and then maybe he stays around, or maybe the Niners don't get back what they want as a return on investment for Deebo Samuel. What do you do with Brock Purdy? Because I think he has warranted an extension at this point in his career. But there are those people, and I'm sure those people exist within the Niners organization, that are questioning, okay, just how valuable is he, though? Because this team has been so incredibly talented, the pieces around him have risen his game to such a level that there may be those people in the organization that question, okay, well, could this team be great if they have any quarterback at their disposal?
And Kyle Shanahan's the one coach that has shown, whether it's Jimmy Garoppolo and now with Brock Purdy, to be able to do that, to elevate quarterback play. I think a scenario that I would have been really interested in San Francisco, if Sam Darnold didn't have the bad playoff performance, Sam Darnold was in San Francisco a year ago, is there was part of me that would say, man, don't pay Brock Purdy. You know, maybe you tag and trade him or something, but don't pay him. And then you just bring in Sam Darnold and you pay him 70% of the cost of, or maybe less than that, honestly, of Brock Purdy. And you roll with that and then you can fix other areas in the roster. I don't think that's what they're going to do. I'd be very intrigued by that still even today if I were the 49ers. But typically we know how this goes. Like, when's the last time a franchise, honestly, has had a quarterback that a year ago was playing at an MVP level? I understand the name Brock Purdy doesn't like excite people, but he was a year ago, not this year, but a year ago, playing at a very high level, to your point about being in the Super Bowl, Logan. And those guys usually don't they don't let those guys walk. They don't usually trade those guys. I mean, Tua got paid because he was next man up, basically. And it's not that Tua's not provided them some opportunities to have success. He has. We saw what they were like without him this year at times. So I still think Brock Purdy gets paid, but I would understand, and I would be exploring how much faith do you have in Shanahan with Sam Darnold, and if you think the Vikings are not tagging him too. That's the other thing. You don't know if he's available.
And Aaron Rodgers is possibly an option, right? I think that it's way out there, and I would be shocked by it. But if you don't want to pay Purdy, Shanahan and
where he's from?
He's from that part. Why would you sacrifice a 26, 27-year-old quarterback who could be your very, very distant future for a guy who might be a 1 or 2 year stopgap? And we're not sure he has it anymore.
Well, that's the thing. I don't think he has it anymore. At least with Sam Darnold, if it works out, you got him for many, many years. Mm-hmm. Rodgers, he can be great for 1 year. I don't think great is left in the tank for him. But if you think that it's still a 1 year, 2 year thing, then you got to go draft a quarterback again. The only way I'm not signing Purdy, honestly, is if I think I can get Sam Darnold or somebody like that.
I think another one to watch isn't necessarily the team, but it's what the Cowboys do with Micah Parsons.
Yeah.
Just because the conversation is like the culture reset, and you know, Micah Parsons is doing a lot of talking on his podcast and all these other things, which obviously he has the right to do so. But it, as we know with the Cowboys, it tends to look like a little circus at times with Jerry and everything and all the stuff that happens off the field more than it even does on. But Micah Parsons is in his prime, or in a spot kind of like what he hasn't forced to trade, because I think he believes that the Cowboys can win still. Like, there's a lot of talent on the roster. They just have to stay healthy and kind of put it all together. But you got a new head coach in there. Is this one of those things that you just say, you know what, we're going to get what we can from Micah Parsons because we can still get a lot right now and make the team as a unit collectively maybe a little bit better in the long run, instead of just keeping him? Or, you know, and also if they do decide to trade him, I mean, who is willing to give up whatever is needed to get Micah Parsons, and what would it cost
the same teams that would be in the mix for Myles Garrett, right? I mean, I think it'd be very similar, a lot, right? The asking price would be a lot, but what you said about take the long-term view for the Cowboys, the problem is that's not Jerry Jones. Like,
oh yeah, right.
You know, that's just not how he operates, especially now at his age too. Like, he thinks every year they can win the
Super
Bowl.
Which is why he probably won't get traded.
Yeah, and what they'll do is they'll wait to the very last minute, like they did with CeeDee Lamb, and they'll end up in Dak Prescott, and they'll end up paying way more because they'll wait and they'll wait and they'll wait, and they end up paying. This is what happens every single time with a star player, I feel like, in Dallas, is under Jerry Jones and Stephen Jones. They act like they're going to play hardball, and then ultimately, like a week before the season, they get the deal done anyway, and they end up, I wouldn't call it overpaying, they just pay more than they would have if they would have got the deal done 3 months earlier. So, yeah, Micah Parsons, I don't think as a player
it's a storyline
right
for sure.
Yeah. Like Myles Garrett, I get why he wants out, and if I'm the Browns, I would trade him. You're not going anywhere. The Cowboys, I understand we can make the jokes and all that, but like to your point about the roster, you don't trade away a player like Micah Parsons if I'm the Dallas Cowboys.
Not defensively. I mean, he's the stalwart of that unit, right? And that unit took a step back this last year, but Parsons was still very, very effective in his role. You lost Dak Prescott, and it tanked your team's chances, right? I don't think Dak Prescott is the guy that can bring you to a Super Bowl. I've never thought that, but he is a guy that puts you in as a playoff team. And with him back next year, that NFC East is going to be fascinating to watch with the Eagles, with the Commanders, and now with the Dallas Cowboys, although I think the Cowboys are the third team in that trio. You have to keep a guy like Micah Parsons around. If we've learned anything, and I say the same thing in regards to Trey Hendrickson with the Cincinnati Bengals, edge rushers in the National Football League today are as important a position as you're going to find in the NFL, maybe outside of the quarterback position or left tackle if you want to throw that into the ring, but that's because they have to block edge rushers. They are such a massive part of a team's defensive game plan week after week, and there aren't many, if any, that are as consistent on a down-by-down basis and as great on a down-by-down basis as Micah Parsons is. And if they are better than him, in your opinion, My assumption is that they're a few years older, a la Myles Garrett and TJ Watt. The future of that position resides in a guy like Micah Parsons, and I think it would be foolish if the Cowboys were to do something other than extend him for the long period.
Yeah, Brian Schottenheimer, of course, the first-time head coach now with the Dallas Cowboys as well. Somebody on the text line, we were going through storylines because Adam Schefter once again said that Matthew Stafford, where he ends up, is his number one offseason storyline. A lot of people saying Aaron Rodgers, and that goes back. That's the link with the Stafford thing. Does that have a trickle-down effect? But overall, it's the second time in the last 3 years where Aaron Rodgers' offseason destination is somewhat of a storyline. I mean, I guess there's also a scenario he retires, just like it was before. I don't know if he goes on another ayahuasca trip and decides where to end up when this is all said and done. Did you watch the Netflix doc?
No.
I watched 1.5 episodes and then I was done.
I want to watch it. I haven't gotten to it yet.
1.5 episodes and then I was done.
Because I think he also talks about his family a lot in there as well with the whole his brother Jordan going on The Bachelor or whatever it was. Yeah, him is, he's had interesting, like just last 20 years of headlines where it's him being the quarterback as well as the family stuff off the field. A lot of people, you know, the whole he doesn't have a relationship with his family and everything like that. It's very interesting. I need to watch it.
Again, the Steelers, one of the favorite offshore odd-wise landing spots for Aaron Rodgers. We'll get back to the NFL in 15 minutes, including an update on Travis Kelce and what his decision could be. Diana Rossini had an update on that. We'll give our thoughts and tell you what that is here in about 15 minutes or so. The other news in the NFL, though, was around yesterday afternoon. The salary cap, we all knew it was going to go up. That's not thing new. As long as it's not a pandemic year, the cap goes up every year. That's how this thing works. When they add more international games, when they have new TV deals with Netflix, et cetera, more money coming in, obviously the cap goes up. Here's the latest figure. The NFL informed teams 2025 per team salary cap is going to be in a range of $277.5 million, potentially as high as $281.5 million. That is up from last year considerably. $255.5 million is where it was. That means over the last 2 years, it could be a $53 million increase. Great for the players. Great for the players. The one thing is funny always with this storyline every offseason. It's like, well, this is great news, Logan, for the Chiefs. This is unbelievable. Now they got so much more money. As if the 31 other teams also aren't getting a salary cap increase. Like, yes, it is a good thing for the players. Great. If you're Trey Smith, it's great news. Great timing for you. The cap keeps going up. Great news for players in the league. They should continue to have, if the revenues are up, of course, the players should benefit as well. Makes a whole lot of sense. That's how this whole thing works. Is it nice that the Chiefs are going to have some more cap space? Sure. But a lot of this, they project out. Like this, I bet you Brett Veach, they were not stunned with the salary cap going up. If anything, maybe it went up a few more dollars than they thought, but they're never caught off guard. They get paid to be able to project years in advance. They already have projections, of course, for 2027 and 2028 of where they're going to be at. That's how the whole thing works. So yes, it's good. The salary cap's going up. It means that these random national folks that want to act like the Chiefs, oh my gosh, they're in cap hell, Logan. They have nowhere to go. They have nowhere to spend this money. Like, that stuff is ridiculous. That's not true. But at the same time, like, the cap goes up for everybody.
Yeah, I mean, yes, the Chiefs now have an extra potential, you know, $22 to $26 million to play with. But they're still the number 24 team in the National Football League in total salary cap space. Like, that has not changed because everybody's getting the same amount of money. And I think it goes to show you that the NFL is not going anywhere. This is the most popular sport in the United States today, and it's only seemingly getting bigger, right? Hence the reason why they're going to Brazil and Germany and Spain and Ireland, and you know, now they're going to Australia for the first time. That is where this league is headed, is it's headed to an international stage. And you're right. Yes, it gives the Chiefs a little bit more money to potentially go and re-sign Trey Smith in the long term or re-sign Nick Bolton in the long term. But it also means that other NFL teams now have more money to outbid you if they feel like it. I mean, the Raiders now have like over $150 million in cap space right now. Like, it's absolutely insane how much money they have at their disposal. The Patriots are in a similar situation. The Chargers are in a great spot, and they're going to be in a better spot probably when they cut Joey Bosa, which I think is a very likely scenario to happen this offseason. So, yeah, and we all know, right, there is something to it. Somebody in the text line just mentioned, you know, more money for Veach means more than with other owners or front office people. Yeah, he's a guru when it comes to that sort of stuff. But they all work in the same realm. And what Veach can do with it, how he can stretch that money, is something that is, I think, envied by the rest of the league. But stretching that money is not going to help you keep Trey Smith and Nick Bolton around. Those are pretty cut and dry scenarios. And other teams around the league are going to be willing, in my view, to pay a little bit more than I think the Chiefs are going to be willing to pay Trey Smith. And I think you're in a, it's a situation where all this money is well and good, and it's going to help you find guys to fill roster spots. It's going to be able to maybe you can go sign a left tackle now if you feel like it. But in regards to re-signing Trey Smith, I don't think it moves the needle.
Well, just the salaries we're about to see in these free agent contracts, whenever, like, whether it's a wide receiver or anybody else, and whether they sign with Kansas City, on day one of free agency, when it officially opens up, right, there's the legal tampering window and all that, but when it officially opens up and when you see, like, X player gets, you know, deal, and you're like, oh my God, it's a terrible deal, it's a ton of money. Just remember that the salary cap went up $20 million, $53 million over the last 2 years. So I remember this, the prime example of this was, it's probably been 3 years now at this point. Remember when Christian Kirk signed with the Jags?
Yeah.
And he had a good first year. He didn't, and this past year, I think he got hurt, if I'm not mistaken, or something. But everybody was like, what the hell are the Jags doing? You know, and I'm not saying that they're a great, you know, well run necessarily. They finally got rid of Trent Baalke. But the point was, we were all stunned with the dollar amount. So don't be surprised if we're stunned by dollar amounts guys are getting this offseason. But that's the way this is going to continue to go. The Chiefs, though, will have the cap space to accomplish what they want to accomplish. It's not just because the cap goes up, but that cap dollar amount that you reference also is before there might be any restructures. And we know Mahomes has been willing to do that time and time again. Remember, they're still getting their money, can convert stuff to a signing bonus or whatever. And so it's that goes on the owner, right? Whether or not the owner cash flow wise is willing to do that kind of stuff, because it requires you being, you know, flush with cash by NFL standards. I understand you're like, well, all the NFL owners are. I am. Some are wealthier than others. And that's the issue that Mark Davis has run into out in Las Vegas. The big reason why he took on sold ownership shares to Tom Brady and company.
Yeah, it's going to be fascinating. And we know Mahomes has shown a willingness to do that. The ownership has shown a willingness to do that. I think that for the sake of the organization, you should do that, because by converting money or pushing money back towards the end of the contract, you can continue to try to win and be competitive with Mahomes at the helm, right? I mean, as of now, his cap hit is somewhere in the avenue of $65 to $70 million next year, all told. That's a lot. And you can, there's these weird intricate ways. And I know somebody last night when I was hosting After Hours said something about deferred money. The NFL doesn't really do deferred money in the sense that, like, Major League Baseball does.
You can do void years, but you can.
Yes. And the all in all, you can defer the money, but it has to be paid out over the life of the contract. You can't pay it out in 2035 when Mahomes' contract is 4 or 5 years, you know, over with at that point. It has to be paid out by 2031, I believe, when he signed that 10-year extension. All of that $500 has got to be paid out by then. So, yeah, you can continue to push it back or push some of it back year after year after year. And then in 2030, 2031, we as Chiefs Kingdom need to just collectively understand, hey, we're not going to be very good. You know, I don't know what the answer is, but we all know what Veach has been able to do and how he's been able to maneuver the cap year after year after year. I mean, goodness, nobody gets penalized for being over the NFL salary cap. If so, the Saints ownership would have had to sell the team 20 years ago, because they have been in cap purgatory for most of our lifetimes. So there are always ways to maneuver it. And I know Veach and company are the best in the league right now at finding those. And I'm very, very interested to see how they can make this work. Some have said that this is going to be a rebuilding year for Kansas City. We don't do rebuilding years with Patrick Mahomes at quarterback and Andy Reid as the head coach of this team. It's not going to be a rebuilding year. This team's going to win the AFC West again, and they're going to compete for a chance at a Super Bowl again.
They, again, have the second best odds to win the Super Bowl next year. But a lot of questions, though, to answer and holes to fill. But acting like they don't have the resource to accomplish what they want to accomplish, I think, would to your point there, would be foolish as well. Coming up in about 8 minutes, we'll get to the latest on Travis Kelce, his decision perhaps leaning a certain direction based on some national reporting. We'll get to that in just a bit here on Cody and Gold. Alex Gold, Logan Weber, Drew Nixon with you on a Thursday. Real quick, I wanted to get an update on where things are trending for college football, because we all know the controversy by some during the college football playoff was like the seeding and how much of a mess it was, and why was a team, for example, like Boise State given a bye over a team from a Power 5 conference, basically, and why was the seeding set up? It created a pretty easy path for some teams compared to others, right? That was the narrative from the minute it came out. Well, there was a meeting yesterday in New Orleans. There was a joint meeting between the SEC commissioner, Greg Sankey, and then Tony Pettit, I think it is, or Petit, or whatever his name is, there for the Big Ten. He's their commissioner. And he said that they agreed, those two agreed, to look at seeding changes. So you would have maybe in some view a more even seeding aspect, right? That the way teams are seeded in the 12-team college football playoffs should change. Now, they're not the two that can make the decision, even though they're the biggest power brokers in college football at this point in time in the power conferences and everything. But remember, this has to be agreed upon by everybody. That's 10 commissioners and then Notre Dame, because we all know they're independent as well. The four highest ranked conference champions got the top four seeds this go around. It was basically the controversy of the entire thing for a lot of people. So I'm not anti-redoing the seeding. What I think is funny, though, is like, am I agreeing to it if I'm in the Mountain West? Because, again, it has to be unanimous. Now, you can try to put pressure on a conference or whatever, but this isn't just like the big boys get to decide. You do have to get the Mountain West, who is going to also turn into a different conference here very soon, because Boise State and these other guys are leaving to go to the new Pac-12, again, not to confuse you at all. So I think most of the conferences are agreed to the seeding changes, but if I'm a Boise State and I'm a Mountain West conference or the new Pac-12, I'm saying, wait a second, why am I doing this? You're basically trying to make it so we're left out of the party here a little bit.
Yeah, the only people that seem to blatantly benefit from a decision to change the seeding are the SEC, the Big Ten, and Notre Dame. I mean, right, Notre Dame had an opportunity. They could have been considered for a first-round bye, and they didn't because they're not in a conference. You can't be a power conference champion. You can't get a first-round bye. So obviously they are going to join the fold as part of that group that's going to be talking about changing these seedings. But if I'm the Mountain West, if I'm the American or Conference USA, if I'm the ACC or the Pac-12, why would you be in favor of changing the seeding? Because college football today, as we know it, is dominated by the two big conferences, the Big Ten and the SEC, right? A great deal of the talent resides in those two conferences. A great deal of the monetary rights reside in those two conferences. They are the most powerful and wealthy groups in the league. The Big Ten and the SEC are. What is the benefit for the Big 12 or the ACC to say, yeah, go ahead and change the seeding so that we might lose the possibility of even getting a first round bye in the first place? Because if that would have been the case this year, the ACC and the Big 12 would not have gotten a bye at all, right? I mean, the Big 12 ended up getting Arizona State. Without that ruling, they're barely inside the field. They're probably the number 12 team, and they've got to go play a 5 seed. And then you've got Texas and Penn State who are getting first round byes.
Yeah, I think that the model, and Drew, we talked about this at the time back in December as well. Like with the SEC, they want to basically have the top four teams earn the top four seeds and first round byes, regardless whether they're the conference champion. That's what the SEC like. That's what the SEC would like.
They
want
to try
happen.
To get the AQs for the Big Ten and the SEC.
The other way to solve this is just to expand the playoff again, right, and go from 12 to 14. That solves some of this, but the problem is we know
More
if it expands
there,
if it gets to 14, well, the SEC and the Big Ten want to guarantee, you know, three or four spots each conference, and then really there's only four spots in that hypothetical up for grabs for everybody else.
And then you get to 14, and 14's so close to 16, right? Something's going to happen. The Big Ten and the SEC are going to get mad again. Oh, let's balloon it to 16. Okay, now we'll go to 20. It's just going to keep getting bigger and bigger.
If I were the Mountain West or any of the Group of Five conferences or the Big 12, I'd want them to go to 16 straight away instead of 14. You might as well. It makes it guarantees you two teams in there. You change up your conference championship game, which That already is being. I don't know if it was the same meeting. I think some news came out of that meeting
as well.
But
that can't happen until after 2026, I think.
Yes,
expansion
correct.
Of the
team. Yeah, so, as far as seating can change as soon as possible.
If they all agree, it could change for next year.
It is interesting. If you went to straight seating like what they're proposing, Boise State would be the 8. They would have hosted a game in Boise against Tennessee.
On the blue.
Not that they wouldn't have won. Not that they would have won the game, but that conceivably would have been cool. I don't mind the straight seating as much as because I get it kind of screws some teams out of it, but Boise State was good enough last year. They were already inside the top 10 anyways off of their regular ranking.
All right, coming up next, a little update on Travis Kelce. Which direction is he leaning toward in the retirement conversation? That's coming up here on Cody and Gold.